If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Do you have weak, damaged hair? New Garnier Fructis hair filler systems fill hair with strength 7 layers deep. In just one use, you can reverse up to 1 year of damage to hair smoothness. The sulfate-free hair filler plus vitamin CG system gives you up to 79% stronger hair and up to 4 times less breakage. New Garnier Fructis hair filler is available now on Amazon and at Walmart, Target, Ulta, Drug, and select grocery stores.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In today's episode, we'll be travelling back to prehistoric Britain with the broadcaster and academic Alice Roberts. Many of you will know Alice as a presenter on TV programmes including Coast, Time Team and Digging for Britain. She joined me to discuss her new book Ancestors, which delves into Britain's prehistory through the stories of 7 burials and looks at what we can reconstruct about this period using new scientific developments. Your new book, Ancestors, explores the prehistory of Britain through 7 burials, and it's funerary sites that you're looking at here. Why are they particularly revealing for this era? What kind of things might you find in a prehistoric grave, and what can they tell us?
Oh, graves are a complete treasure trove very often of information, and you get all sorts of different information in graves. So some of the later graves that I've looked at in the book, thinking about graves like that of the Amesbury Archer, for instance, are absolutely stuffed full of cultural artefacts. So what we've got is a brilliant time capsule and a little microcosm of that Copper Age culture. It's absolutely wonderful. But there's also a treasure trove of information in the bones themselves. And the book is also about how we're extracting more and more information from those bones. And for me, as a biological anthropologist, it's just been astonishing how that science has developed over the last 20 to 30 years.
I definitely want to ask you more about those advances in science later. But let's talk a little bit about prehistory first. So I think for a lot of people, this might be fairly cloudy and foggy in their minds if we're talking about the British Isles. What do you think that the public's perception of Britain's prehistory is, and what misconceptions do you come across most regularly?
Yeah, I mean, prehistory is, I find it intensely interesting because obviously it is before written documents. And the only way that we can approach it is through archaeology, through the material remains of ancient cultures, through the physical remains of our own ancestors, and through traces of constructions and later on buildings. So you are left looking at those traces in the ground, and there's almost then a kind of forensic process that goes on where you're trying to reconstruct what life was like, and even trying to understand perhaps what society was like and what people were thinking using those traces, whilst all the time, you know, not having any written words to help you. But I it is extraordinary how much we can tell. And also it's extraordinary how far back in time we can push it. So, you know, in terms of a prehistoric human presence in Britain, we can go back all the way now to, you know, nearly a million years ago, with evidence of stone tools and also footprints as well, on the beaches in East Anglia. But if we're talking about burials, the first burial that we have in Britain in prehistory, so the very first burial in Britain, is that of the Red Lady of Paviland. And that's the grave that I choose to open the book with. But that does take us back more than 30,000 years into the past. So it's quite astonishing, that depth of time. You know, it's before the peak of the last ice age, when ice sheets came down over Britain. So I think people are aware of that. I think, you know, people know that as you go back into prehistory, you're getting into the Pleistocene, you're getting into the Great Ice Age, and that the landscapes that we see around us today have been, you know, covered with ice from time to time, or in the south, you know, they've cycled between being tundra and then being, you know, more open and sometimes even wooded. So, you know, we are talking about the Ice Age for a big chunk of that time in prehistory. But then after the Ice Age, we're coming out into the later bit of the Paleolithic, the Old Stone Age, and then into the Mesolithic, when people start to settle down a bit more in the landscape. And then I think, you know, when I'm doing my talks and engaging with the public, people are pretty clued up actually about the kind of sequence of events. They know that you have the Stone Age, and then you have the Bronze Age, and then you have the Iron Age. And the transitions in and out of those are slightly different in different countries. So you can't, I suppose to a large extent, the actual date at which for instance, the Stone Age stops and the Bronze Age, or actually the Copper Age now fits in between the Stone Age and the Bronze Age, where that starts, is based on obviously the objects that you're finding, and you're never going to see the very beginnings of it. But also there's a theme of continuity. We don't see usually whole cultures exploding onto the scene overnight. We see a gradual kind of accumulation of changes, and then we go, right, we're into the Iron Age now. Sometimes there is an explosion of culture, and that's a really interesting point that I unpick in the book as well.
You mentioned earlier advances in science, and there are some truly spectacular things that we can find from these discoveries these days. Can you give us an insight of nowadays, if we get to a prehistoric grave and we find bones in it, what could we tell from those bones using cutting-edge science?
Okay, so if I'm presented with a skeleton, or I've just dug up a skeleton, I can tell quite a lot actually just by looking at the bones themselves, just by with the naked eye. And I was amazed when I first started in this area of research, because I came into it from a background as a medical doctor. And so when I first started learning the business of osteoarchaeology or biological anthropology from the wonderful Juliet Rogers, who is no longer with us at Bristol University, I was just astonished at how much she could tell. You know, coming into this as a medical doctor, I was thinking, you know, well, goodness me, it's just a skeleton. I can't ask this person anything about themselves or where it hurts or whatever. I can't do blood tests. There's so much I can't do, which I would do as a doctor. And I suppose because I was a doctor, my fascination is with disease in ancient remains. But actually, there's a lot you can tell. So bone does respond to disease if you're ill for a certain period of time. And there are some diseases which are very characteristic in the way that they affect bones, things like syphilis and TB, for instance. And then one of my obsessions has been arthritis, so looking for signs of osteoarthritis. And that's very easy to see on the surfaces of joints with the naked eye. You see little tiny holes on the surface of the joint. You see sometimes if the cartilage is completely worn away in a joint and two pieces of bone have been rubbing together, then you see a kind of ivory, shiny texture on the surface of the bone. We call it ebonation. So we can look at patterns of arthritis through time, for instance. And you can also look at teeth, obviously, and we see that people in the past suffered from dental disease just as we do today. So the types of things you might see are calculus building up on the teeth. So that's when plaque becomes mineralized, and that can lead then to gum disease and recession of the bone around the tooth. And so eventually the tooth falls out and the tooth is lost, and the bone heals over. The socket is resorbed completely. We see evidence of abscesses. Although I suppose what I should say is that compared with our teeth today, most prehistoric people had much better teeth because they didn't have quite such a starchy, sugary diet as we do. I mean, I don't think they brush their teeth as fastidiously as we do, but their teeth are nevertheless in, you know, usually in very good condition. So there's a lot you can tell by looking at the bones on the surface. And then, of course, you can employ techniques like radiography. So you can use x-rays to look at bones. And that gives you more clues to hidden features of the bones, for instance. You can also use computer tomography. So again, using x-rays, but CT scanning the bones. And we've done some work at the University of Bristol using micro CT scanning, which I'm actually describing one project in the follow-up book to Ancestors right now, because that involves Roman infant bones. So it's just into the historical period, where my colleague Kate Robson-Brown in the Archaeology and Anthropology Department at Bristol did some micro CT scanning of infant bones where we'd found cut marks, and we were able to see that the cuts in those bones, which were just visible to the naked eye, were V-shaped and cross-section. We were essentially able to virtually slice up the bone with the micro CT scanner. We could see that they were V-shaped and cross-section. They'd been made by a probably a metal knife, and that also they'd been made in antiquity because we could see sediment in the bottom of those cuts. So there are ways of analysing bones, you know, where without cutting them up, but you're still analysing them at a kind of microscopic level. And then there's lots of chemical techniques that you can use. So you can look at the constitution of bones and teeth and look at ratios of different elements in bones and teeth, which are really useful in terms of telling you where somebody grew up, for instance, or where somebody spent the last decade or so of their lives. And, you know, our bodies are made out of our surroundings. You know, our bodies are constantly in communication, I suppose, with our surroundings. You make your body through what you consume. And so there are signatures of the landscapes that we grew up in, written particularly into teeth. So in tooth enamel, which is laid down in childhood, you are incorporating certain types of oxygen, for instance, and certain types of strontium in various ratios that we can then analyze and then say, right, where do those ratios exist in terms of the geology of Britain or further afield? So we can use those kinds of what we call stable isotope studies to ascertain where somebody grew up and maybe they've been buried in a different place from the area they grew up in. So that's one of the kind of, I suppose, relatively recent advances. And then what a lot of the book is about is the ability to extract DNA from ancient bones and to sequence it. And this is something which has just come on in leaps and bounds when you consider that the first human genome was fully sequenced in 2000. And then since then, the ability, first of all, to extract DNA from very ancient bones, but also then to work out how fragments of DNA, because you're going to be sequencing lots of separate fragments of DNA to build that up into a genome. All of the technology to do that has come on in leaps and bounds as well. And in the book, I describe the beginning of a project which is running at the moment at the Crick Institute, run by Pontus Skoglund and his lab, where the aim is to read 1,000 ancient British genomes.
I wanted to ask you about the 1,000 Ancient Genomes project, because it's clear that you're really passionate about it. Why do you think that it is so exciting? What do you hope that it might reveal or that we might be able to learn from it?
What we've been doing with DNA in the past has been either analysing specific sections of it, so perhaps looking at mitochondrial DNA, which is not inside the nucleus of your cells, but is contained in mitochondria, and Y chromosome DNA, which can give us a little bit of an idea about how males and females were moving around in the past. But it's only a very tiny bit of DNA. So with whole genomes, we're able to look for rare variants, for instance, which might give us clues as to when particular groups of people have come into Britain. And obviously the movement goes the other way as well. And sometimes we might actually be able to try to reconstruct something about those people as well. So, for instance, I talk about Cheddar Man in the book and the analysis of his genome. And there's a lot of probability built into this, but the geneticists think that it's quite probable that he had fairly dark skin and blue eyes, so quite unusual looking. So being able to find that out from a skeleton just seems utterly extraordinary. So there's a lot of information. There's also information about kinship, about relationships between different individuals. And that's been quite profound when it comes to looking at, for instance, the communal burials that we find inside Neolithic chambered tombs. And there are a lot of different theories about what those chambered tombs are about, whether they're about anonymizing the dead, and those people represent people from across the whole community, or whether they were perhaps effectively family vaults. And from some of the genetic analyses that have been carried out fairly recently, we are getting hints of this idea of them being used for families. So we're seeing familial relationships between different individuals where their DNA has been sequenced. So, for instance, a father and a daughter from Primrose Grange in Ireland, and also in Ireland, a father and a son buried in two separate tombs, but fairly close to each other. So perhaps we're looking at branches of the same family very close in the landscape. And even at Newgrange, an incestuous relationship. So an individual, a man buried at Newgrange, who is either the incestuous son of a parent and a child, or of two siblings. So we can see that in his DNA. So we're seeing some quite extraordinary details, some of which may not have been, public knowledge to the people in that community even.
Yeah. So you mentioned there that one of the things they're looking at is migration. And historians and archaeologists love to debate about migration and its impact on Britain over time. What do you think that this might reveal? Do you think this might put an end to these debates?
I don't think we'll end the debates, but it's an important strand of new evidence that certainly has the potential to settle some questions. It's not a kind of panacea. It's not going to answer everything. And I think what we'll see happening is that ancient DNA will help us answer many longstanding questions about mobility and migrations in the past. But then actually we're left with a lot more questions at the end of it. And so it's not as though ancient DNA somehow supersedes archaeology. It doesn't at all. It's a tool for archaeologists to use, and it will help us see the picture more clearly. But it is quite a disruptive technology. I mean, I think it's probably as disruptive as radiocarbon dating when that came along. Suddenly archaeologists were able to pin actual dates, absolute dates on organic material, whereas in the past they'd had to do mostly relative dating. So I think ancient DNA is probably going to have a similar kind of disruptive effect in archaeology. And you kind of see that playing out. I mean, it's quite interesting to turn our cultural anthropological gaze on ourselves now and look at how this technology, so much of what I'm talking about is how, new technologies like metalworking, that would have been a disruptive technology when it appeared back in the Copper Age and the Bronze Age. And here we've got an example of another disruptive technology, which is going to change how both disciplines work, in fact, and the questions that both disciplines are asking. But I think that, there have certainly been some instances of geneticists treading on toes, shall we say, delicately. No, they haven't been delicate. So there's been a perception from some archaeologists that some geneticists have kind of waded in to very long-standing debates, centuries-long debates in archaeology, and have just gone, well, you've been arguing about this for ages. We've got the answer now. And not surprisingly, the archaeologists have said, well, hang on a minute. I think you need to learn a bit about archaeology and the kinds of questions we're asking first before you just come in all brazenly saying, and here's the answer. So I think that we're seeing that really well in terms of the 1000 Ancient Genomes project. So we're seeing a really beautifully collaborative project between geneticists and archaeologists and engaging, Pontus Skoglund is engaging with probably now hundreds of archaeologists up and down the breadth and length of the UK, and you know, asking them what they want to know. Mm-hmm. You know, what are their burning questions, and what can he help them with? Some things he won't be able to help them with. Some things will be beyond the limits of ancient DNA to answer. You know, at the same time, he's interested in looking at migration and mobility in Britain, and there'll be lots of very discreet questions about individual sites, which he'll be able to collaborate mm-hmm. with those archaeologists on. And also, in fact, you know, within his team, there are people like Tom Booth, who is actually a geneticist and an archaeologist. And I think that helps when we've got these two disciplines mm. that feel quite separate. We've already got people who actually have a foot in both camps, who are both archaeologically and genetically trained. So I think that's a really powerful way of bringing these two disciplines together, which is what we've got to do. I mean, that we've got to capitalize and maximize the power of ancient genetics to help with archaeological conundrums. And that's the way we'll do it.
Well, that's, I think, is one of the most interesting aspects of the book, is not only the sites themselves, but how the art of archaeology has developed over time. And you talk in the book about the people who first made some of these discoveries. So people like William Buckland, Pitt Rivers, Richard Gough. And I was just interested in who you found some of those most interesting, colourful characters and how they reflected ideas from their own time onto the finds that they made.
Yeah, so one of the people that I got quite obsessed with, as you'll probably be aware, is Pitt Rivers. And, you know, as an early archaeologist, he came up with some really, really interesting ideas about how cultures had changed and evolved over time. And he was interested in collecting. He was interested in cataloguing and understanding what was happening in different periods through time. But he was also interested in how those transitions happened. And he was very influenced by evolutionary theory. So he was thinking about ideas that were coming through from biology in the 19th century and then wondering how those might apply to culture.
It sounds very familiar with what we were talking about just a minute ago with the kind of cross-pollination of disciplines.
Yeah, it does. It does. And he starts to think about whether the origins of new cultures might be linked to the movement of people. So, for instance, he has a theory that the Bronze Age people represent, they obviously have a new culture compared with Neolithic people. But is that, are they new people? Have they just picked up this culture? Perhaps, maybe just a few people have traveled and that they've picked up this culture from a few people and then that culture has taken hold and has spread. So a kind of idea of cultural diffusion, or, you know, has there been a population replacement effectively where that Bronze Age culture is actually coming with a whole load of new people? And he suggests, on the basis of skull measuring, that might have happened. So he does some craniometry, particularly looking at skulls that were found on his own land in Cranbourne Chase, and says, look, I think I can see a difference between the Neolithic skulls, the shape of the Neolithic skulls, and the shape of the Bronze Age skulls. So he's kind of trying to do with skulls what we would now do with DNA. So now we would take the DNA and say, well, you know, is there a difference in that DNA? Is there enough of a difference to say that actually we think we've got a lot of people coming over in the Bronze Age and that the populations that were there in the Neolithic have been largely replaced? And what's astonishing is that the evidence that is coming through at the moment does suggest that. So we've got a lot more work to do, but certainly the indications are that we've got quite a big population replacement happening in the Bronze Age. So when we see the beaker culture emerging in Britain, that is coming with a new group of people. The Neolithic people haven't completely disappeared, but there's a really profound turnover of population. So now we know that, then you start to think about what that means in terms of the contact between these two groups of people with their different cultures, and how much communication there was between those different groups. And what we can see, what, you know, we need to look at it site by site, country by country, site by site, and look at what was happening in a really fine grained way at different places. Because in some places it might be that we have, you know, the two communities existing side by side, but essentially operating a sort of apartheid for a while before they merge together. And then in other places we might see a swifter merge. So it's getting, I mean, it's just really fascinating the level of detail that you can get into. But what it does, I think, this new technology makes us look at archaeological theory, because archaeological theory over time has changed a lot. And I do think of probably all scientific disciplines, archaeology is probably the most introspective in that way. It's very aware of its own philosophy, which I think is extremely useful. And I think that other areas of science could learn a lot from that, because of course there's always some kind of philosophy that we have in the back of our minds when we approach a particular set of observations or a particular problem. And I think that archaeology has been very good at being self-aware about that philosophy and about preconceptions in a way. And I think where we're at now, and especially with these new technologies coming in, it encourages us to try to move away from having preconceptions. So try to look at the evidence in isolation to begin with, and then try to kind of build it up and build up a bigger picture. But it is interesting. I think that philosophically we probably are moving into a different way of at least not doing archaeology, but thinking about archaeology now.
Yeah. It sounds like archaeologists are going to have stuff to keep them busy for a long time to come.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But this one was intact, standing up, and the individual, the man, was buried in the chariot as you kind of expect, and he was in a kind of crouched position to fit him into it. But the other utterly extraordinary thing about this is that there were two ponies in the grave as well. And not only that, but these two skeletal ponies were standing up.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Each of the chapters in your book looks at a site and it gives you a real sense of place. You take the reader with you to this prehistoric site. So I just wanted to ask you about some of those sites. What are some of the most evocative or atmospheric sites that you were able to visit that, you know, still have a real sense of something special happening there today?
Well, I think that, you know, some places you go to and there's nothing there today. So you're kind of left, I suppose you feel that there's something special about the place because you know about the archaeology. And for me, that gives me a real sense of being kind of rooted in the landscape. So particularly going to places like Paviland Cave, and Paviland Cave is one of the places that I really, really wanted to include in the very first series of Coast on BBC Two. And when the producer said, you know, what are the places that you think definitely should be in this series? I said, Paviland Cave, you know, it's the earliest burial in Britain. And I met up with my friend and colleague, Paul Pettit, on a beautiful sunny day to go and walk down the cliffs at Paviland, just on the Gower. and go and make our way to Pavlan Cave. And, you know, now it's quite an epic cave. I mean, it looks out over the Severn estuary. It's a big teardrop shaped entrance, but it's, you know, it's been excavated. So you're not in there to look at the archaeological remains. You're there to look at the landscape and think about how different that landscape might have been 34,000 years ago when the Red Lady, who was a man, of Pavland was buried there. But I do think that archaeology imbues the landscape with a kind of, it's the depth of human existence, isn't it? And the thinking of all the people that have been in those places before us. And although this book is a lot about genetics, it's not about trying to trace genetic links between us now and people in the past. Because, you know, once you get back into prehistory, those are not terribly meaningful anyway. And I'm really keen to say in the book that, you know, these ancestors belong to everybody. You don't have to have a direct genetic link with the Red Lady of Pavlan or with the Amesbury Archer to, you know, think about what the lives of those individuals were like and think about the landscapes that they lived in. So I think it's quite an egalitarian approach to ancestry and the landscape that I'm after. Yeah. You're here. When I visit Pavlan Cave, I'm there as a human in the 21st century thinking about the human experience of somebody who lived 34,000 years ago, one human to another human.
Yeah. I actually wanted to ask you a bit about the Amesbury Archer, because he is one of the most fascinating figures. Of course, he was found near Amesbury, which is in itself near-ish Stonehenge, and that has coloured the way that a lot of people have spoken about him. What are some of the debates about his identity, and what do you think that his grave can tell us about the time?
Well, it is a stunning grave. It's still the most richly furnished Copper Age grave in Britain, and I think in Europe as well. I mean, it's absolutely stunning. So this individual, this man was buried with almost 100 different objects in his grave, and it was a timber lined grave. And in that grave, he's buried with wrist guards for what we presume are wrist guards for archery, and there are lots and lots of flints. Some of them are arrowheads, which gives him his name. There are copper knives, and there are 5 bell-shaped beakers in there with him. So this is the kind of classic beaker package. And he looks like somebody who is certainly special in some way, you know, high status because of the way that he's buried and the number of objects that are buried with him. And there are also other graves very, very close by. So the burial of the Boscombe Bowmen, which again relate to a similar kind of period, and they are close to Stonehenge. So, you know, you start thinking, are there links between, you know, these individuals and Stonehenge? And there may be, but we'll never be able to prove that. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about the Amesbury Archer is that the analysis of his stabilizer tapes shows that he's not a local. Mm-hmm. Shows that he grew up somewhere around the Alps, and then ended up in Amesbury. And so, I mean, I think graves like his show us just how wide these connections were across the landscape and the distances that people were traveling. I mean, I think sometimes we think that people in antiquity are only, you know, maybe traveling to the next village, and that's about as far as they went. But no, we've got people who are traveling, you know, sometimes hundreds of miles in a lifetime. And he's right at the dawn of the Copper Age. So those are the kind of facts about him. Then you start to speculate about who exactly he was. You know, are we looking at some kind of Bronze Age shaman or magician? You know, what did people think of these people who had the ability to extract metal out of stone? I mean, it must have been amazing. To see that, and to see this new material, this completely new material, emerging into cultures. So yeah, he's a very exciting burial, and he absolutely had to be in the book.
I think that those questions lead me on actually quite nicely to another question I have, which is, what are some of the most puzzling things that have been found or puzzling debates that people have had about some of these burials that archaeologists still are arguing over today?
Well, I think now that we're starting to piece together a bit more about mobility and migrations, and we'll, you know, that we're in, it's still, it's very early stages for this. So it's a very kind of exciting area of investigation. But I think that as we start to piece this together, the questions about how culture then spreads really come to the fore. And also, I think the realization that, you know, culture doesn't appear in one single package, that actually, you know, the origin of things like the Amesbury Archer's copper knives might be different from the origin of the idea behind his beakers, for instance. So, you know, we're seeing lots of different ideas. You know, wherever you are, I always think about it as ripples in a pond. And the culture in this particular area, in one particular area, draws on ideas from lots of different cultures around you. So I think that kind of overly simplistic idea that you have one particular culture in one place and then it just spreads, you know, maybe east to west is the kind of tradition, isn't it? The light from the east. We're starting to really kind of break that apart now and see that actually ideas are traveling in lots of different directions. And in order to really understand that, we've got to have very, very well-dated sites in order to see how those different aspects of culture come together and relate to each other. And I think that there are hints of really interesting connections between material culture and other aspects of culture, particularly with these Copper Age and Bronze Age individuals, because we have got this link with the Amesbury Archer. You know, he, in his own lifetime, he's travelled from the Alps to the UK. Other people in the Bronze Age, so there was a big project called the Beaker People Project, which showed that there was quite a bit of mobility during the Bronze Age, but a lot of it was within Britain. So yes, there are connections with the near continent, of course there are, but there's also a lot of mobility going on within Britain. But then as we go back further in time, we see the roots of the Beaker culture perhaps starting in Portugal. But then if we track it back further through the genetics, then we find that actually this wave of expansion of a population, merging with other populations along the way, comes from the Pontic steppe. So it's a steppe population that expands across Europe from about 5,000 years ago. And if we tie that up with a particular culture of the Pontic steppe then that's expanding, then this is this culture called Yamnaya. So a culture where people were using pit graves, which is where the name comes from. And what we also think is happening is that those people are bringing a new set of languages into Europe. So this is an amazing kind of coming together of ancient DNA, of genetics, of archaeology, looking at material culture and linguistics, where we think that these people are spreading out of the Pontic steppe and bringing a different material culture, but also bringing different languages with them as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those kind of, I mean, when that paper came out, looking at the Yamnaya and those connections between linguistics and genetics and archaeology, I don't know if 20 years ago anyone would have ever, you know, even thought that that would have been possible to make mm-hmm. those kind of connections. So that's why it's so exciting at the moment.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the Pocklington chariot burial, because it's so show-stopping, really, isn't it? Why was that such an exciting find? And I wonder if you could describe it for us.
Yeah, so the Pocklington chariot burial was discovered by MAP Archaeology, who'd been digging in the area for quite a while. But so it was in 2016, they discovered a chariot burial, which was chariot burial of an adult man with a chariot which was intact and standing, And it's the first one that's been found like that in historical times, as in, you know, we've actually, the archaeologists have seen it. There may have been, I mean, there were chariot burials discovered in the past that may have had intact chariots, but they weren't recorded. So it's the first known intact chariot. Other chariot burials that have been found in recent times have tended to be dismantled, so completely flat-packed before being put in the grave. But this one was intact, standing up, and the individual, the man, was buried in the chariot as you kind of expect, and he was in a kind of crouched position to fit him into it. But the other utterly extraordinary thing about this is that there were two ponies in the grave as well. And not only that, but these two skeletal ponies were standing up.
Which is just mind-boggling.
Just unbelievable. So I talked to Paula Ware, who was the lead archaeologist digging the site, and Melanie Giles from Manchester University, who's a consummate Iron Age expert, about this. And we spent quite a long time kind of scratching our heads and thinking, how on earth did they get these ponies in? Are they winching dead ponies into the grave, or are they, and then somehow supporting them, maybe piling up the soil underneath them, piling up the earth underneath them to support them in a standing position? Or are they led into the grave and then killed in the grave? It's just, it is quite extraordinary. And because it's such a feat, you kind of go, well, I don't know if we'll ever quite get to the bottom of how they did it. But obviously it was extremely important to have that design, I suppose, in the grave, to have that chariot looking as though it was just ready to depart, with the ponies taking this dead man off to the afterlife, presumably. I mean, if that's what they believed in, we don't know they believed in an afterlife, but it looks like they're intending something with that journey. And then what there was as well with that grave was evidence of the funeral feast. So you get this impression of a funeral which is a great spectacle, and is definitely about show, is definitely about the status of that individual. But also, of course, what funerals are about is the status of the surviving family as well. So, you know, that big show of I suppose, power and status is as much about the survivors as it is about the individual that's being buried. And it looks like a big show that was also a big feast. So there are animal bones in the grave, and in particular, a rack of ribs with a meat hook still in it.
That sounds like a good wake, doesn't it?
That's just extraordinary. So this looks like parts of the feast that are being shared with this individual as he goes off to the afterlife, if he's going off to the afterlife.
Yeah.
So yes, it is an extraordinary burial. And these Iron Age burials up in Yorkshire are very unusual, because across a lot of the country in the Iron Age, we don't see many burials. We see some burials down in Dorset, and then we see these very characteristic ones up in Yorkshire. And it's called the Arras culture, and that does have connections with the near continent. So it may be that it's a particular group of people who have come with their definite style of funeral with them.
So in these chariot burials and of the time, would it primarily be men that are buried there?
Well, no, it's not always men. So we can look at human skeletons and say whether they're male or female with quite a high degree of accuracy, if we're able to sex them. Some of them we have to just give up and say they're indeterminate. But what we know is that some of these chariot burials very definitely have women in them, including the Wetwang chariot burial. So that's interesting, because I think antiquarians in the past would have very quickly jumped to a conclusion on the basis of the style of the burial, or perhaps artifacts that were buried with the body, as the Reverend Buckland did indeed with the Red Lady of Paviland. You know, the name is stuck, but it's quite clearly a male skeleton. He didn't think it could possibly be a male, because that individual was buried with what looked to him like ivory jewellery. And, you know, as a 19th century antiquarian, he couldn't stomach the idea that a man might be buried with jewellery. But, you know, those kind of ideas still persist. So that in the Iron Age, when we find burials with swords, there's sort of the assumption that it's a man. Or if you find a burial with a mirror, there's an assumption that that's a woman. And I talk a little bit about the need to get away from our own cultural lens again and accept that there may have been many more diverse identities in the past than perhaps we have today. You know, we kind of think that we are, I don't know, that our society and culture is normal in the way that it tends to have, for instance, we tend to have two genders. So I'm not talking about biological sex, I'm talking about gender. And we, you know, we tend to say, right, there are just two genders. And then some people raise their eyebrows when somebody says, well, I don't feel like either one of those genders, or, you know, I don't fit into this binary pattern. And perhaps that's what we're seeing in the past, is a much more diverse approach to identity. So that, you know, certainly when you find an Iron Age burial, and there has been one of these, it's got a sword and a mirror. That's telling you something quite interesting, I think, about identity in the past.
Fascinating stuff. So finally, I know that earlier you cautioned against trying to, you know, pin down some solid genealogy type link between us and these prehistoric people. But do you think that there is anything we can learn about ourselves by looking at prehistoric Britain?
I think what we can learn from ourselves about ourselves by looking at prehistoric Britain is just how multicultural Britain has always been. And that what we see over time is many, many, many different groups of people coming to Britain. And of course, the movement would have been in the other way as well. We're not just receiving people. People would have crossed the North Sea and the Channel in both directions. And that all of those cultures enrich each other. So I think that's probably the biggest lesson for us today.
That was Alice Roberts. Her book, Ancestors, A Prehistory of Britain in Seven Burials, is available now, published by Simon & Schuster. I spoke to Alice for the July issue of BBC History Magazine, which is on sale now and also includes features on the Black Death, the Cuban Missile Crisis, cricket in the British Empire, and catastrophes that changed the world. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. We'll be back tomorrow with the final episode in our series on Britain's greatest prime ministers.